have to tip my cap to the conservative, anti-worker, right-wing movement. That whole gang has been far more focused in a laser-like way on seizing power in places where it can matter a lot, mainly the local and state political arenas. And progressives, until recently, just didn't focus enough on state capitals and local races, letting the right wing dominate state legislatures and local city governments. And that's meant really bad things for workers to the tune of billions of dollars in lost wages. As we will hear today from an expert who has looked at a little wonky legal thing called preemption. And with the strike by thousands of workers globally against Amazon just wrapping up the other day on Amazon Prime Day, I'll remind us what a corporate terrorist the company really is. This is Jonathan Tessini, and this is the Working Life Podcast for July 17th, 2019. As usual, a reminder, this podcast is sponsored by the American Postal Workers Union, which fights for dignity and respect on the job, decent pay and benefits, and safe working conditions for its 200,000 United States postal employees and retirees and nearly 2,000 private sector mail workers. You can hear the podcast on the Progressive Radio Network on Thursdays at 6 p.m. You can find it on Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, all sorts of places on the internet. Of course, we depend on small financial supporters as well, so please go over to workinglife.org. Click on that podcast tab. I know I say this every week. It's time for you to do that this week. Since you've been listening to this podcast week after week, look for our link to Patreon, become a financial sponsor of the show at whatever level you can afford. It will be money well spent. So what the hell is quote-unquote preemption? I've actually come across this a lot in the labor world over many years. You may sometimes ask, for example, why doesn't a state like California, which has more progressive politics, simply say, we will pass a law making it easier for workers to organize, and we will have a state body that oversees union organizing drives in the private sector. Well, the problem is that private sector organizing is covered by the federal National Labor Relations Act, which then, quote, preempts, end quote, any other government body at the state or local level from setting up its own system. Now, there's some logic to that. Having one system makes sense, and you could actually have situations when it comes to workers and unions, and of course other issues like civil rights, where a state actually undercuts and makes worse the process for union organizing. And I'm going to put aside for a moment the point I've made before on this podcast. Even the best case federal labor standards today really suck, and it's a system that's designed to give companies advantages, mainly to delay, any fair elections or negotiations. But let's stick with the notion of preemption. What has happened below the radar in half the states, and it's mostly so-called red states, conservative states, is that corporations and their lobbyists and allies, especially something called the American Legislative Exchange Council — if you haven't come across ALEC, you should look them up. These folks are really venal and very effective. All these folks have been quietly getting laws passed to shut down campaigns to raise the minimum wage and other pro-worker policies. Basically, the laws they've been able to get passed say, roughly, you, the city or county, can't pass your own law about minimum wage because the state will decide what those standards will be. In other words, any state law and standard, and this is what the right wing has been able to do, preempts anything that a locality, like a county or a city, wants to do in the area of worker standards. And now half the country, 25 states, have statutes at the state level preempting local minimum wage laws, which then has led to the invalidation of laws that have already been passed by a Democratic vote in cities and counties nationwide. Here to talk about this very dangerous development is Laura Huizer. Laura is a senior staff attorney with one of my favorite organizations, the National Employment Law Project, and she has co-authored an extremely important study on the whole preemption scam. This is great timing to talk about your terrific report, Laura. And as we know, Amazon workers just went on strike. And I thought that that uprising actually was a good time to look, if you will, at the underbelly of what is happening. And you talk about this in your report, what is happening kind of at the state level that is almost undercutting both the attempts by workers to organize unions and also the movements that we've seen throughout the past several years to raise wages, the $15 an hour movement, and all sorts of other movements around people's real desire to try to have a basically good living. And one of the things that happens, and you're an expert at this, you're a policy wonk, if I can use that term, and I mean that in a very positive way, because I am too. Lots of folks focus on the federal level, on Congress, on what's happening in the presidential level. And actually, corporate America has figured out that the way to attack people's wages is to really go after people now at the local and state level. Now that they've essentially eviscerated the ability of unions in many ways to organize, they figured out that this movement around wages, this $15 an hour movement, and lots of other movements have been quite effective in many localities. So they figured out that they have to make it impossible for us, for progressives, to advance wages and working conditions and other things at the local level. And your report really does a great job at it. And I thought that I would just take off from here and then let you kind of riff on this. What struck me was your chart that actually took a look at 12 localities, and they included, I believe, five counties in Iowa and then several other cities around the country where there was actually an attempt to raise wages. It passed. Many workers were going to get wage hikes to the tune of, you calculated, roughly $1.5 billion. And basically now the corporate lobby went in and undercut all that attempted democracy and the ability of workers to get those wages, right?
That's right. And thank you so much for taking a look at our report. I think that what we really wanted to do was show in very concrete terms how what the corporate lobby is doing in state legislatures around the country is costing workers billions of dollars each year. So our report actually looked at those 12 cities you mentioned over that they're located in six states, Missouri, Alabama, Iowa, Kentucky, Florida, and Wisconsin. And we found that workers in those 12 cities that tried to raise their own local minimum wage are losing $1.5 billion annually. And that's about 350,000 workers just in those places that tried to pass their local laws. And we estimate that on average, each of those workers is losing about $4,000 per year. So $4,000 a year could make a huge difference for a single worker, for a family, you know, for entire communities. And so we really wanted to take this corporate campaign that's happening in state legislatures and put it in those dollar terms.
Mm-hmm. And you did a great job at that. And I encourage my listeners to go to NELP.org, NELP.org, and really read through this report because it really does illuminate such a pernicious and awful trend that I think does not get enough attention. Now, talk a little bit, maybe at the micro level, the mechanics that you found that these corporations use. So let's say I'm involved in a movement and we are all successful at democratically getting our legislators to approve a hike in the minimum wage. What then happens?
Right. So first, I think it's important to also note that it's at the local level these days where workers and, you know, working people and people of color have more political power. In many cases, that's where they know their local elected officials and they can push the kinds of policies that they think will make their communities better. And when that happens, you know, in these cases, when cities have passed a higher local wage to respond to those needs in their constituents, we've seen the corporate lobby sort of shift and go after the state legislature where they have a lot of lobbying money, you know, pumped into campaigns for officials there where they exert a lot of influence. And so they use their influence at the state level then to basically have the state pass a law that then invalidates any kind of local minimum wage law. They say the state is going to take away the power of cities and counties to raise their own wage. And so we end up with what, you know, these laws that are called preemption laws that take away that local power. And so we end up in a situation now where workers and local communities no longer have the opportunity to work with their elected officials to try new things or experiment with policies that they think will make their lives better.
And in your map, a great map that you had in the report, it was pretty clear that a lot of this happens in so-called red states, in more conservative states. And this really is a result of the, really over the last 25 years, the focus on the part of Republicans and conservative activists to take over state legislatures. One of the stats that I point out is that the Democratic Party, and I guess to the extent the Democratic Party generally, although not always, unfortunately, represents higher minimum wage policy and the advocacy for better wages for workers. We know there are corporate Democrats, but generally speaking, essentially, Democrats have lost enormous amount of power across the country, something like 900 legislative seats during the Obama years. And so that has allowed these legislators to be dominated by Republican legislators, sometimes with a supermajority, and having a Republican governor, so they can actually implement these preemption laws. And actually, we're creating, from what I read in your report, almost two Americas, because as you state in the beginning of the report, a total of 25 states have statutes preempting local minimum wage law. So you have 25 states that allow it and 25 states that don't allow it. So we're really creating two Americas, right?
That's right. And it is very much a product of this consolidation of power at the state level for conservatives and for the corporate lobby, essentially, where they can use their money and influence very efficiently. And yes, we now have 25 states that preempt local minimum wages. We actually had 26 for a moment, but Colorado became the first state to repeal an old preemption law that prohibited local wages in Colorado. So we're actually now also starting to see that local communities and workers are catching on to what's happened in recent years. They're realizing that they've lost a lot of their power, basically a lot of their independence at the local level to do what's right. And so they're trying to reclaim that power now by repealing state laws in places where they've basically regained some of that power at the state level too. Colorado is one of those places.
And even taking a so-called liberal state, and its liberal tag is a little overstated, no pun intended. And I'm thinking of New York. Look what happened because of the last election. As you well know, for many years, people in New York City were trying to change the rent laws. And because of the way the legislature was aligned, the Republicans controlled the state Senate, it was essentially impossible to get back what they call home rule and to basically impose and allow a locality like New York City to be able to structure its own rent laws and make them more renter friendly. And the real estate lobby was really very powerful, obviously bought up a lot of legislative chits, donated to many legislators. But in the last election, the Democrats were able to take control of both houses of the legislature, and a nominally Democratic governor, Andrew Cuomo, signed a much stronger renter protection bill that now essentially implements what the renters lobby and the pro-renters movement has been trying to do for almost 2.5 decades, which is to get much more powerful rent laws in place. So it does make a difference, and it can make a difference all across this country, and especially around wages.
Exactly. And we would say, even as more states are progressive communities and more states are reclaiming their power at the state level, it's still crucial to understand that the corporate lobby is not going to stop this campaign to preempt progressive laws at the local level. I think we understand that, you know, conservative state legislatures and the corporate lobby, we'll continue to see cities and counties as the place where workers and essentially working families are trying out new policies and ideas to see if they will, in fact, make their communities better. And so at any point, we think where that kind of momentum builds for progressive movements, we're going to see preemption of those laws or an invalidation of those laws. And so we're going to continue to see this back and forth between the state legislature and local governments. But I think we're starting to see that more local governments and local communities are standing up to protect their local power to try new things to make their communities better.
One of the mouthpieces of the corporate lobby is something that we've known about for a very long time, the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. And essentially what they do is they provide templates to these conservative legislators about how to implement these kinds of preemption laws. Does the progressive movement have an analogous organization or an analogous piece? Is that what NELP does to some extent?
There are absolutely progressive efforts to educate legislators at the state level on policies that are important to their constituents, and of course to offer model language or model bills for how to do that. But I think that at the end of the day, we're still at a point where organizations like the American Legislative Exchange Council are funded by the corporate lobby. They have so many more resources behind them. And so the battle to, you know, go to legislators and show them model bills for progressive issues so that they can do what's right for working families will continue to be a tough fight.
Yeah, it feels like we're sort of outgunned, honestly, because of the obviously corporations have a whole lot more money. They have endless resources. They can pour it into organizations like ALEC to change the laws. But in a way, and money's important, but some of it is about focus. I think the progressive movement really has not paid attention enough over the past, say, two decades to the state level, to the localities where these kinds of things happen. It's changed, and I'm sure you can speak a little bit about that. But would you agree that part of the problem has been the lack of focus and the lack of attention to what was happening?
I think that for a long time, the corporate lobby was using preemption to invalidate minimum wage laws and some other local policies. But it is becoming clear to more and more people, I think, that the corporate lobby is completely abusing that kind of tool. And we're now seeing preemption of basically every progressive issue you can imagine, from plastic bag bans to smoking regulations, gun control, paid sick leave, and, you know, the list goes on and on. So I think as the corporate lobby and state legislators abuse preemption more, folks are waking up and they're realizing that this is a concerted campaign that requires a concerted effort to fight it back. And we're starting to see even more cross-issue coalitions coming together in places like Florida and saying, no, this preemption bill that targets business regulations also targets anti-LGBTQ discrimination protections at the local level and wage theft protections and so many other things. And so folks are starting to come together and fight back together. So hopefully that will shift the tide over time.
And maybe my last question to you, it seems to me that if we sort of draw back away from the details of preemption and legislation and all the nitty gritty, this really is a fundamental question of democracy. Because here you have lots of people, regular people, average people, workers banding together, going to the legislators, getting something decent passed that stops poverty, that raises wages, that makes sure that people are not in hunger, and income corporations, and they essentially buy the process and they pervert the democratic will.
It's absolutely an issue about democracy. I think we've seen that the abuse of preemption at the state level has done significant harm to local democracy in recent years. And we've seen that it basically has canceled out the voices of Blacks and Latinos and other people of color at the local level who want to experiment and are calling out for stronger rights and protections locally. So we believe, of course, that communities of color and working families and progressive groups should be able to exercise their local powers to improve their communities and do that without interference from the state and from the corporate lobby. So we absolutely see it as an issue of democracy and equity and justice, and we hope to see more local communities and voters pushing back against the abuse of preemption.
Regular listeners know that I've devoted a lot of time to the stain on the economy called Amazon, especially the devil's spawn known as Jeff Bezos. And of course, you can check out all those podcasts in our archive by going to workinglife.org. You may have noticed that there was a strike this past Monday around the world by thousands of workers on the occasion, actually, of Amazon Prime Day. By the way, I hope none of you used Amazon during the strike. Or maybe you've even taken my own step, never to use Amazon, which hurts workers and small businesses. I thought I'd re-air two especially good segments on Amazon, both about the various ways that Amazon avoids paying taxes. Remember, this is the company that is the most valuable corporation on the planet and will soon reach a market value of $1 trillion, and it's run by the guy who was the richest man on the planet until his divorce, and he's had to hand over half of his fortune, I believe, to now his ex-wife. I feel no sympathy for him, obviously, nor should you. The first segment is with one of our regular guests, Matt Gardner of the Institute for Taxation and Economic Policy, and the second segment features Oren Tyker, the CEO of the American Booksellers Association, who has a special bird's eye view of Amazon, given the destruction that Amazon has caused to the booksellers' business. So first up, Matt Gardner. And Matt, it's always great to have you on the show and giving us all this important information. Although I have to say, the thing about this is that you always raise my blood pressure really high and get my level of outrage really high. So I'm not sure if it's good for my health and my sanity, but you've done it again. And because on the whole podcast, we've decided to talk about Amazon because Amazon is doing so many bizarre things, difficult things for communities. I saw your blog post, which was really astounding. And people can see that blog post and all of Matt's work at ITEP.org. And Matt's colleagues also write there on taxation and economic policy. But I'll read the three sentences and then just ask you to riff on that I got from the blog. In 2017, Amazon reported $5.6 billion of U.S. profits and didn't pay a dime of federal taxes on it. And then just below that, you write, the company's 0% rate in 2017 reflects a longer-term trend. During the previous 5 years, Amazon reported U.S. profits of $8.2 billion and paid an effective federal income tax rate of just 11.4%. So here you've got a company that analysts estimate is going to have a market capitalization of $1 trillion pretty soon, and yet they're not paying taxes.
Yeah. Well, I can see why that would get your blood pressure up. So, and I do apologize for that. It's an occupational hazard if you look at tax policy too much. I think it's not especially surprising from a larger picture. We know that a lot of the biggest companies have found ways to reduce their federal tax liability pretty consistently and pretty far. And we know that this has been happening even as these companies, including Amazon, have been pushing for a reduction in federal income taxes. Mm-hmm. It's compounded in Amazon's case because, as is now widely known, it's a multi-level strategy for them. It's not just pushing for reducing federal income taxes, which they don't really pay. It's a consistent pattern of pushing for state tax cuts and, where possible, trying to reduce their state taxes on their own. Amazon was, we've had this long running battle at the state level where internet based retailers, foremost among them Amazon, have been trying to basically outcompete brick and mortar retailers based almost entirely on this tax advantage, where they can find ways to sell things to you over the internet, but brick and mortar stores still have to collect sales tax, and they don't. And they've been remarkably successful doing that. So that was an advantage they sought on their own and achieved on their own. And now, of course, Amazon, in a way we've never really seen before, is sort of forcing state and local governments and cities to compete against each other to see who can offer the biggest tax incentive package to encourage them to bring their HQ2, the new headquarters there. And, you know, that would be distasteful enough on its face, because we know, certainly suspect, that in general, when companies seek these tax incentives to relocate, they're pretty much just asking for tax breaks for what they were going to do anyway. But it rings especially false in a setting where, man, you know, Amazon really does appear to be a company that's basically untouched by the tax code to begin with. To ask for tax breaks, there really ought to be some requirement that you're fully participating in the tax code to begin with. And all indications that Amazon simply isn't.
And so, to the point you were making midway through that comment, they have legions of lawyers, I assume dozens, if not hundreds, but let's assume dozens or scores of them, whose whole sole job it is to try to avoid paying taxes. And let's underscore to people that they're doing something that unfortunately is legal. And so in a certain way, they're getting away with things that politicians, those people who pass these tax laws, and they're frankly of both parties, they're the ones letting Amazon do this.
Yeah, that's a completely fair assessment. At the federal level, with the income tax, Amazon finding a way to zero out their corporate income tax this year on the $5.6 billion of profits. There's no reason to think that's anything except them using the tax breaks Congress has enacted for them. One for executive stock options. I'm sure there's some depreciation stuff in there, and some other unspecified tax credits add up to a 0% tax rate. Congress could have changed that in the past anytime they wanted to. They didn't have to cut the income tax rate for everybody to achieve it. They could have closed loopholes and by and large refused to do that as part of this tax bill. And at the state level, you know, the thing that made Amazon a big company to begin with, avoiding sales taxes, Congress could have stepped in 20 years ago, or certainly 10, when it was clear how central state sales tax avoidance was to Amazon's business plan. The Fed certainly could have jumped in and fixed that and chose not to do it. So, you can certainly say that Amazon has tried to make tax avoidance part of their profit maximization strategy in a way that most other companies, to an extent that most other companies really haven't, but you can only pin it on them so far. It's every bit as much the fault of Congress.
And to your point that there are lots of politicians at the state and local level, and your point about this competition for their HQ2, the second headquarters sweepstakes, is really relevant here. There are plenty of local politicians, again, from both parties, who are just on their knees begging Amazon to come to their community and willing to give them all these additional breaks, including breaks from sales tax.
That's right. And, you know, anytime state and local leaders, elected officials face this dilemma, to some extent, you have to feel for them, because, job one for them is economic development. They want to bring good jobs to their city, to their state, and they want to foster a positive economic development climate. They want, at the same time, not to be seen as the guy who kept Amazon from coming to town. They desperately want that. And those two things are actually kind of different and lead you in different directions. If you care more about avoiding the negative headline. Amazon didn't come to Baltimore or Philadelphia or Chicago or wherever else they're currently looking, then that leads you to a no holds barred, give Amazon a suitcase full of money approach to economic development, which is very narrow and, you know, and can lead you down the wrong path. If you're thinking more holistically about economic development, then you're not asking, how do I get Amazon to locate here? You're thinking, how do I get a much larger suite of companies, including companies that are more obviously job creators, to come here and to stay here?
And if you were a bold politician, someone with some courage, you could actually, on your second point, say, I did not want to give away the store, metaphorically and literally speaking, to Amazon. And therefore, we said no. And, you know, you could, if you had that courage and you could explain it that way, you could actually garner positive feedback from your constituents. And let's face it, politicians are, by the nature of it, political animals and are worried about getting reelected. But you can turn that into a positive.
I think so. Certainly, when you look at the scale of what some states and cities have offered Amazon, or to give another example, what Wisconsin has been trying to give to Foxconn, the Apple supplier, for their thing. You know, when you're talking about billions of dollars, it's very straightforward for anyone to understand that offering incentives on this scale in a constrained fiscal environment means you're going to have to hike taxes on everybody else, or you're going to have to cut services. You're going to have to spend less on roads, less on healthcare, less on education. That hurts everybody. So there ought to be a way for brave, erudite politicians who are willing to spell this stuff out to make it clear to people that one company is not going to be an economic development solution. Certainly, if it's a company like Amazon that is as likely to fill their factories with robots as people.
And so now I don't want to get away from this other second really important point that you made about the way in which Amazon is taking advantage of this recent tax cut that was passed by Congress. And let's say, you know, you've written a ton about what an outrage that is. That's my words about the way in which what that tax package did was harmful to the country, to individuals. It benefited corporations. And you guys have written about this forever in terms of repatriating profits. They're basically getting basically free money. But talk about what Amazon is doing in terms of now being able to pay a lower rate than they would have paid. And it's based on basically deferring the taxes they should have paid like everybody else.
That's right. There's two interesting dimensions to this. One is in the U.S. and the other is abroad. Start with the U.S. part. The way a lot of companies, including Amazon, are able to reduce their taxes in a given year, sometimes it's just about taking a tax credit, which just reduces your tax. Other times it's about deferring tax, saying, well, I'm still going to pay tax on this $1 million of income, but I'm going to use this tax break to postpone it for a year or 5 years or 10 years. Amazon has been pretty good at deferring its tax bill in this way, postponing it to future years. And at the beginning of 2017, they had a big pile of postponed tax liabilities. And they already had an estimate in their heads, in their accounting heads, of how much they were going to have to pay in the future on this income from the past. And those estimates had been accrued at the 35% statutory rate that was then in effect. Mm-hmm. Along comes the Trump tax bill, reduces the corporate tax to 21%. Now, this older estimate of the big pile of postponed tax liabilities, they get to reduce it by 40% because 21% is, you know, it's 60% to 35%. So they got a big tax benefit, $790 million this year as an earnings boost, because they figured out that 40% reduction in all that prior income that they had been able to postpone tax on, now, whenever they pay it, it's not going to be now, it's still in the future, they're going to pay $790 million less than they otherwise would have. A huge windfall for them. And the same thing happens on the foreign front, where any company that's been offshoring profits, you know, whenever they brought it back, they were going to have to pay at 35%. Now with this repatriation, this deemed repatriation, they're paying at a rate that's, you know, way lower, no higher than 15.5%. So, you know, Amazon, like other companies, has been playing a game where they've found ways to postpone their tax in the hopes that they get a tax holiday abroad and a reduced corporate tax rate at home. And this new tax bill gives them both of these things, giving them huge rewards now and going forward.
Now, let's be clear to people, when we're talking about repatriating foreign profits, it's not like it's put on a ship and shipped back. It's basically a paper transaction, and it's basically an accounting thing. So that, let's be clear, this is completely to the advantage of the company. They've been basically sheltering it by putting it on some balance sheet somewhere, and it's in theory in the Cayman Islands or wherever it is, but it's not really money that's sitting offshore. It's just a paper transaction. How much? I know that Apple and a lot of the manufacturing companies and companies that have intellectual property have been stashing a lot of money overseas. Has Amazon had the same kind of pile of cash at that level?
Well, as a starting caveat, nobody else matches up to Apple.
Yeah.
You know, Apple and Pfizer are the two companies that have had like over $200 billion offshore. As you point out, it's hard to know what offshore means. All it means for accounting purposes is wherever it is, they're not paying taxes on it and they don't want to. But Amazon's offshore stash has always been smaller by comparison. At the end of 2016, the last year before all this stuff took effect, they had $2.8 billion of permanently reinvested offshore cash. That's profits on which they might have paid some tax to somebody, but they weren't telling us. And they weren't paying any U.S. tax because they stated that their intention was to keep it offshore forever. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot, but if you look at their cumulative foreign profits, they really haven't had a whole lot. I mean, you could look at their history of foreign income and say, man, $2.8 billion sounds like just about all the profits they've ever earned outside the U.S. So, yeah, it's a lot smaller than Apple. But it sure looks like a pattern of saying that basically all of their foreign income is staying offshore. So I would certainly count them as a company that has used indefinite deferral, this ability to postpone paying your tax on offshore cash, every bit as effectively in its way, on its scale, as Apple has.
And so the main point to say overall is what they've done is they've been very, very, very intently focused on not paying taxes in a variety of ways over a number of years. They're now using the recent Trump tax bill to stash and get even more back, that $789 million one-time tax break. And of course, to state the obvious, regular people like you and me and millions of citizens don't get to postpone these kinds of tax liabilities, and they don't then get this huge break. They get whatever that $1.50 that Paul Ryan promised to one person out there, which has now, you know, made the headlines. But average people are getting, you know, bubkis, if I can use a technical term, and they're getting huge amounts of money. And to state just the overall point, this is really penny wise, pound foolish, because if you look somewhat at Amazon, that's actually trying to build a new headquarters, is trying to build these warehouses where they need roads that function, that can get people to the warehouses to work, that can transport the goods that Amazon is selling. All these things are falling apart because there's not enough money in the treasury. It's being given away to rich people and the elites rather than invest in, for example, infrastructure. So it's very short-sighted.
Yeah, I think that's totally fair. A couple of interesting points you make there. One, you know, you talk about us versus Amazon, everybody else versus these companies. The irksome thing about the repatriation holiday, the irksome thing about the deferred tax stuff more generally, is that the companies that have reaped the biggest rewards from the repatriation provision are, weirdly, the companies that have acted the worst, that have been the worst actors. And what I mean by that is that to get a really big payoff from this tax bill as a company with offshore profits, you need to be a company that just doesn't have offshore activity. It's a company with offshore activity in tax havens. And the companies that are reporting the biggest repatriation tax bills are also the ones who have the biggest repatriation savings, and in turn are the ones who had the most cash in tax havens. So, you know, we're absolutely rewarding the worst actors. And I think it's fair to say that Amazon, on a number of levels, has been among the worst actors. So it's irksome, to say the least, to see these companies benefit big time from the tax bill. It's especially irksome to see state and local policymakers trying to bring, as a corporate citizen to their state, someone who I think you can describe as a bad actor in that way from a tax perspective. And, you know, we ought to be thinking, all of us, as part of our economic development, not just about bringing jobs locally, but bringing jobs that are working for companies you can trust, that you think have the basic, that basically are on your side and have the interest of your city or state in heart. And it's hard to say that when you look at the pattern of tax avoidance activities that Amazon has engaged in. It's hard to trust them.
And now let's hear from Oren Tyker, the CEO of the American Booksellers Association. And really, Oren, people really know Amazon as this big behemoth that basically you can get everything on at this point, unfortunately. But really, it started, as you quite well know, you've been in this business for a very long time. It started as an online bookseller. And give us the 1 or 2 minute evolution of this and where you saw Amazon when it first started and what it has become in terms of bookselling.
Well, look, you know, it is absolutely correct. You know, Amazon started in the book business. Actually, Jeff Bezos was famously quoted at the beginning that he said he was going to start with selling books and music, of course, at a time when music was still a physical product. And he was going to do that for a bunch of reasons. First of all, our business have identifiable numbers on the product, so they were easy to track. They were easy to ship because they fit in a box. And frankly, book buyers tended to be a slightly more affluent chunk of the population. And therefore, once he got them hooked on books, he could begin to sell them everything else. I don't think there's any doubt that the vision for Amazon from the outset was to start with books and to grow as they have to become, you know, the world's largest retailer of every product under the sun. Now, books continue to be a piece of what they do, but each year a decreasing piece of their overall business. But nevertheless, for those of us in the book business, they continue to be the 1,000-pound gorilla in the book business, because even with books being a smaller percentage of their total overall sales, you put all the major publishers, all the bookstore, independent bookstores, all the chain bookstores, put everybody else in the book business together, we pale in size to Amazon.
Now, I know that probably many of my listeners know anecdotally of the crisis that now that Amazon in some way created for independent booksellers. And I wonder if you saw them as predatory from the outset. Was Amazon a threat right out of the box to independent bookstores? Or is there something that Jeff Bezos did in terms of unfair competition and monopoly that made the crisis more acute?
Well, I think at the outset, frankly, there were a lot of skeptics that people would go on their computer and use their computer as a way to purchase products. Obviously, as time has gone on, that skepticism has evaporated, and tens of millions of American consumers use the internet as their as the way to access products of every shape, size, and imagination. Certainly, at the outset, none of us understood really what the long-term ramifications and import was of an entity that would be as engulfed and have its tentacles engaged in every conceivable part of American commerce as Amazon has evolved. So I don't think it, I think it's fair to acknowledge that you know, none of us quite understood at the beginning how big it would all become. And there is no doubt that in the book business specifically, the as Amazon got bigger, their outsized influence has distorted our business in a way that ultimately, in our view, is not good for not just for other booksellers, but is not good for publishers, is not good for authors, let alone for the reading public. You know, there's certainly, Jonathan, you're probably as knowledgeable about as ever that as anyone is that, you know, there never has been an example in American history where that kind of concentration of power in the end has benefited consumers. You know, there may be short-term advantages in the competitive environment in which prices to consumers get reduced, but ultimately, when you put all that power, all that concentration of influence in one hand, that never, ever has worked to the advantage of consumers. Certainly in our business specifically, the whole evolution of the ebook controversy is a perfect example. You know, back 6 or 7 years ago, there were a bunch of players in the ebook world that isn't providing digital content to consumers. Apple, Google, Barnes and Noble, others were all in that business. You know, as time went on, Amazon deep discounted digital content radically, well below cost, in order to gain market share. Basically has, fast forward to 2018, has eliminated virtually all her ebook competition, and now prices have gone up. So I don't think there could be much doubt that the impact on our business has been acute. But more broadly, you know, you look at the overall American economy, you know, Amazon is responsible for a net loss of hundreds of thousands. I'm saying hundreds of thousands of jobs across the United States. Their failure to collect tax at the state and local level, you know, we've calculated based on some independent analysis, you know, has cost state and local government almost $1 billion, and I say $1 billion in revenue not collected. The recent announcement of the location of HQ2, in which governments at the state and local level are subsidizing Amazon to the tune of billions, and I say billions of dollars, all to benefit what is clearly one of the world's most successful, richest, most profitable corporations, all strikes us as being, you know, a real problem. And I think, you know, look, you know, as a representative of America's independent booksellers, we understand consumers are going to shop online. And obviously, there are conveniences of shopping online that certainly, you know, at certain times make a lot of sense. What I think the public largely doesn't understand is that the overall economic impact of that concentration of power, that loss of tax revenue, that loss of jobs, the massive amounts of public subsidies, when you put all that stuff together, it's very, very difficult to justify and very, very difficult to say this is good for the overall economy.
And so you made a few very important points in those remarks. And so I want to circle back and start with this issue of the lowest price, because we've seen the impact of that throughout the economy, not just when you talk about Amazon, but take Walmart, for example, which competed against many retailers in that sector and drove prices very low. But the fact is that, number one, as you well know, Walmart pays its workers very, very low. And the people who overwhelmingly shop at Walmart are people who can't afford to shop elsewhere. And so it is that broader cycle in the economy that if wages are not high and we aren't willing to pay something that's not just the lowest price, but a reasonable price to so that someone can make a profit, so an author in the case of books can make a decent living. Then it is this incredible cycle that just descends downward. And that is one of the reasons that I've spent a lot of time on this podcast or on Amazon. And to your point about the recent agreement in New York and in Virginia over the HQ2, you guys did do this incredible study, which I've read, with Civic Economics about the effect on Amazon and American communities. And so let's dig a little bit more deeper into that. You mentioned that, and I looked at the specific New York statistics, the hundreds of millions of dollars in sales taxes from the third-party independent sellers that the state does not collect, the thousands of jobs, I believe in New York, I'm not looking at the number, it was around 40,000 jobs lost because of Amazon, 2,500 roughly stores closed. So Amazon is essentially slowly but surely eating away at our economic base.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, on the tax side, you know, there has never, to my knowledge, been an entity that has grown basically with a policy of tax avoidance. Jeff Bezos famously, when Amazon was launched, boasted that, you know, come shop online and you don't have to pay sales tax, and used that competitive advantage in a way that drove customers. And of course, in New York and other states that have 6, 7, 8, 9% sales tax, certainly the government was inadvertently subsidizing one company. Our position all along has been about that, is that, look, you know, businesses have a right to exist, but they don't have a right to exist at a competitive advantage that the government, in effect, subsidizes competitors. You know, it'd be like going down the street of a bunch of retail businesses and go, eeny, meeny, miny, mo, well, this business doesn't have to collect tax, this one does. I mean, clearly everybody would understand that would be colossally unfair. And Amazon built its customer base largely through this policy of tax avoidance. Now, fast forward to 2018. Now, New York, frankly, was one of the first states to acknowledge this and require remote sellers to collect sales tax. Now, all 45 states that have state sales tax are, in fact, collecting it. And as you probably know, the Supreme Court earlier or last year in 2018 upheld the legality of states and local governments collecting taxes on remote sales as being perfectly constitutional and perfectly legal. But today, as the Amazon business has grown even further, there are literally hundreds of thousands, and I'm saying hundreds of thousands, of other businesses that operate on the Amazon marketplace who, in effect, are continuing not to collect state and local sales taxes. So the direct purchases on Amazon now in those 45 states are all the marketplace sales in virtually all of those 45 states that have sales tax are not collecting those taxes, which is why there continues to be this incredible bleeding of failure for those businesses to pay their fair share. And again, we're not, this isn't punitive. We're not suggesting that people, it's just a question of fairness, is that, you know, if one business selling product or services to a consumer is obligated to collect and charge sales tax because that's what that local government or state has imposed, well, why shouldn't that be an effect for everybody? The continued policy of tax avoidance is costing American taxpayers a whole lot of money directly because of how Amazon operates.
And what that means, to be very concrete, is then when Amazon is costing state and local governments' revenue, that means that essentially Amazon is indirectly or directly cutting services and cutting things that people benefit from, whether you're talking about paving a road or building a subway or fixing some water system. That is a direct effect of Amazon essentially dodging its responsibility because you don't have enough money to do the things you want to do.
I mean, all of those products, I mean, initially those products purchased directly from Amazon, and now certainly those products that are coming through their marketplace retailers, you know, those products get shipped in boxes that get delivered to trucks that use the same roads that you and I pay for by our state and local taxes. And how could it be that they say, well, we don't have to pay for those roads? You talk about some colossal unfairness. If that's their business model, if they're selling products that require distribution over the same public roads that the rest of us use, well, why shouldn't they pay for it? I think the Amazon has created new ways for people to acquire products. And look, I want to be clear. I'm not, suggesting that, we don't want to bury our head in the sand in 2018. Clearly, the internet is an indispensable lifeline for acquiring product for lots and lots and lots of consumers. All we're suggesting is if that business model is viable, as obviously it is, it ought to operate under the same rules that all the rest of us do.
Mm-hmm. And so sort of move now our conversation to how booksellers are responding to this. As I told you just before we came on to record, I'm on a mission to get people not to buy from Amazon. I know that you're not trying to necessarily say that yourself, so that's my position, and that they should actually patronize independent bookstores in their communities. And the first thing that, when you talk about online, almost every bookseller that I know, and certainly the most obvious ones like Powell's Bookstore in Portland, Oregon, has an online business where you can get every single kind of book that you might get at Amazon, right?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, the fact is, in 2018, the internet is not exactly a deep, dark secret. And how one sells product online is available to everybody. The American Booksellers Association operates a program we call IndieCommerce, which provides e-commerce capability for about 400 of our members. There are other e-commerce platforms that stores do. So yes, I mean, if you go to virtually any independent bookshop in America find their website, they have access to exactly the same inventory of titles that our large corporate competitors do. So yes, you can shop at our members online, but of course what we do is something a little different. I mean, what we do in our member stores is create an experience. We create an opportunity for consumers to come in, browse the shelves, and discover books that perhaps they didn't know about. You know, the internet works really well when you know exactly what you want to buy. And certainly, obviously, there are a certain percentage of book purchases that come about that way. But for most of us, it's the browsing of that shelf of books or looking at that table of new releases that one thing catches our fancy or not. And it's when one looks at that array of titles, and look, frankly, it happens in bookstores, happens in libraries as well. It's that ability to discover books that, frankly, is the indispensable ingredient in how the book business works, because it's that discovery of things perhaps you didn't know about that helps drive the business. So we're just to be clear, we're not ever suggesting that people ought not to be shopping online, because certainly we get it that sometimes it is the best and most efficient way to acquire things. But that experience in a physical store is unique. And the good news is that there are millions of consumers who get that. And that's why independent bookstores, despite this incredible competition for Amazon, are actually doing pretty well.
So really, the whole conversation we've just had and the whole conversation we need to have about Amazon is not just the effect it has on, say, booksellers, but the way in which it affects Main Street America and really every corner of the country.
The one you know, thing about indie bookstores that I think is, I think overall that one of the effects of Amazon on the retail space in America is that, you know, lots and lots of retail communities are increasingly dominated by restaurants, by bars, by nail salons, by all the kind of service-oriented entities, and a lot of other retailers who sell physical product are going away. And that, of course, changes the nature of those retail areas and changes the behavior of consumers. So for us, you know, one of the real threats about Amazon is that even though book sales and our members have figured out how to compete, when the local shoe store down the street goes away and the local drugstore down the street goes away and the toy store goes away, that there are fewer customers coming to those shopping districts, which has impact on our businesses. So I think, you know, one of the, you know, kind of broader points about Amazon's impact on America is it is changing what Main Streets look like. And frankly, I think there's a pretty strong case to be made it's not changing it for the good.
That'll do it for this week's podcast. Thanks to my guests, Laura Wiesar, Matt Gardner, and Oren Tyker. Our audio editor, as usual, is David Hebden. Thanks to our sponsor, the American Postal Workers Union. Please do subscribe and support this podcast. You can do that by going over to workinglife.org and looking for the link to Patreon. Thanks for listening. Look forward to having you back next week.